no thoughts of leaving Said. But it was also a difficult one, because in making it, she felt she was abandoning the old man. And even if he did have his siblings and his cousins, and might now go live with them or have them come live with him, they could not protect him, as Said and Nadia could. And so, by making the promise he demanded she make, she was, in a sense, killing him. But that is the way of things. For when we migrate, we murder from our lives those we leave behind. Chapter 6. They slept little that night, the night before their departure from the city. And in the morning, Said's father embraced them and said goodbye and walked off with moist eyes, but without faltering, the old man thinking it best he leave the young people rather than make them agonize over stepping through the front door with him watching from behind. He would not say where he was going for the day, and so Said and Nadia found themselves alone, unable, once he was gone, to chase him down. And in the quietness of his absence, Nadia checked and rechecked the smallish backpacks they would carry, smallish because they did not want to arouse suspicion, but each full to bursting, like a turtle imprisoned in too tight a shell. And Said ran his fingertips over the apartment's furniture and the telescope and the bottle containing the clipper ship. And he also carefully folded a photograph of his parents to keep hidden inside his clothing, along with a memory stick containing his family album. And twice he prayed. The walk to the rendezvous point was an interminable one. And as they walked, Said and Nadia did not hold hands, for that was forbidden in public between genders, even for an ostensibly married couple. But from time to time, their knuckles would brush at their sides. And this sporadic physical contact was important to them. They knew there was a possibility the agent had sold them out to the militants, and so they knew there was a possibility this was the final afternoon of their lives. The rendezvous point was in a converted house next to a market that reminded Nadia of her former home. On the ground floor was a dentist's clinic, long lacking medicines and painkillers, and as of yesterday, lacking a dentist as well. And in the dentist's waiting room, they had a shock because a man who looked like a militant was standing there, assault rifle slung over his shoulder. But he merely took the balance of their payment and told them to sit. And so they sat in that crowded room with a frightened couple and their two school-aged children and a young man in glasses and an older woman who was perched erectly on her seat as though she came from money, even though her clothes were dirty. And every few minutes, someone was summoned through to the dentist's office itself. And after Nadia and Said were summoned, they saw a slender man who also looked like a militant and was picking at the edge of his nostril with a fingernail, as though toying with a callus or strumming a musical instrument. And when he spoke, they heard his peculiarly soft voice and knew at once that he was the agent they had met before. The room was gloomy, and the dentist's chair and tools resembled a torture station. The agent gestured with his head to the blackness of a door that had once led to a supply cabinet, and said to Said, "You go first." But Said, who had until then thought he would go first, to make sure it was safe for Nadia to follow, now changed his mind, thinking it possibly more dangerous for her to remain behind while he went through, and said, "No, she will." The agent shrugged as though it was of no consequence to him, and Nadia, who had not considered the order of their departure until that moment, and realized there was no good option for either of them, that there were risks to each, to going first and to going second, did not argue, but approached the door, and drawing close, she was struck by its darkness, its opacity, the way that it did not reveal what was on the other side, and also did not reflect what was on this side, and so felt equally like a beginning and an end. And she turned to Said and found him staring at her, and his face was full of worry and sorrow. And she took his hands in hers and held them tight. And then, releasing them, and without a word, she stepped through. It was said in those days that the passage was both like dying and like being born. And indeed, Nadia experienced a kind of extinguishing as she entered the blackness, and a gasping struggle as she fought to exit it. And she felt cold and bruised and damp as she lay on the floor of the room at the other side, trembling and too spent at first to stand. And she thought, while she strained to fill her lungs, that this dampness must be her own sweat. Said was emerging, and Nadia crawled forward to give him space. And as she did so, she noticed the sinks and mirrors for the first time, the tiles of the floor, the stalls behind her, all the doors of which save one were normal doors, all but the one through which she had come, and through which Said was now coming, which was black. And she understood that she was in the bathroom of some public place, and she listened intently, but it was silent, the only noises emanating from her, from her breathing, and from Said, his quiet grunts like those of a man exercising or having sex. They embraced without getting to their feet, and she cradled him, for he was still weak. And when they were strong enough, they rose, and she saw Said pivot back to the door, as though he wished maybe to reverse course and return through it. And she stood beside him without speaking, and he was motionless for a while. But then he strode forward, and they made their way outside, and found themselves between two low buildings, perceiving a sound like a shell held to their ears, and feeling a cold breeze on their faces, and smelling brine in the air. And they looked and saw a stretch of sand and low gray waves coming in, and it seemed miraculous, although it was not a miracle. They were merely on a beach. The beach was fronted by a beach club, with bars and tables and large outdoor loudspeakers and loungers stacked away for winter. Its signs were written in English, but also in other European tongues. It seemed deserted, and Said and Nadia went and stood by the sea, the water stopping just short of their feet and sinking into the sand, leaving lines in the smoothness like those of expired soap bubbles blown by a parent for a child. After a while, a pale-skinned man with light brown hair came out and told them to move along, making shooing gestures with his hands, but without any hostility or particular rudeness, more as though he was conversing in an international pidgin dialect of sign language. They walked away from the beach club, and in the lee of a hill, they saw what looked like a refugee camp, with hundreds of tents and lean-tos and people of many colors and hues. Many colors and hues, but mostly falling within a band of brown that ranged from dark chocolate to milky tea. And these people were gathered around fires that burned inside upright oil drums, and speaking in a cacophony that was the languages of the world, what one might hear if one were a communication satellite or a spymaster tapping into a fiber optic cable under the sea. In this group, everyone was foreign, and so, in a sense, no one was. Nadia and Said quickly located a cluster of fellow countrywomen and men and learned that they were on the Greek island of Mykonos, a great draw for tourists in the summer, and, it seemed, a great draw for migrants this winter, and that the doors out, which is to say, the doors to richer destinations, were heavily guarded, but the doors in, the doors from poorer places, were mostly left unsecured, perhaps in the hope that people would go back to where they came from, although almost no one ever did, or perhaps because there were simply too many doors from too many poorer places to guard them all. The camp was in some ways like a trading post in an old-time gold rush, and much was for sale or barter, from sweaters to mobile phones to antibiotics to, quietly, sex and drugs. And there were families with an eye on the future, and gangs of young men with an eye on the vulnerable, and upright folks and swindlers, and those who had risked their lives to save their children, and those who knew how to choke a man in the dark so he never made a sound. The island was pretty safe, they were told, except when it was not, which made it like most places. Decent people vastly outnumbered dangerous ones, but it was probably best to be in the camp, near other people, after nightfall. The first things Say the Nadia bought, Nadia doing the negotiating, were some water, food, a blanket, a larger backpack, a little tent that folded away into a light, easily portable pouch, and electric power and local numbers for their phones. They found a patch of land at the edge of the camp, partway up the hill, that wasn't too windy or too rocky, and set up their temporary home there. And Nadia felt, as she was doing it, that she was playing house, as she had done with her sister as a child. And Seth felt, as he was doing it, that he was a bad son. And when Nadia squatted down beside a scraggly bush and made him squat down as well, and there, concealed, tried to kiss him under the open sky, he turned his face away angrily, and then immediately apologized, and placed his cheek against hers, and she tried to relax against him, cheek to bearded cheek, but she was surprised, because what she thought she had glimpsed in him in that moment was bitterness, and she had never seen bitterness in him before, not in all these months, not for one second, even when his mother had died. Then he had been mournful, yes, depressed, but not bitter, not as though something was corroding his insides. He had, in fact, always struck her as the opposite of bitter, so quick to smile, and she was reassured when now he held her hand and kissed it, as if making reparations. But she was a bit unsettled, too, for it struck her that a bitter Seth would not be Seth at all. They took a nap in the tent, exhausted. When they woke, Seth tried to call his father, but an automated message informed him that his call could not be completed, and Nadia tried to connect with people via chat applications and social media, and an acquaintance who had made it to Auckland and another who had reached Madrid replied right away. Nadia and Seth sat next to each other on the ground and caught up on the news, the tumult in the world, the state of their country, the various routes and destinations migrants were taking and recommending to each other, the tricks one could gainfully employ, the dangers one needed at all costs to avoid. In the late afternoon, Seth went to the top of the hill, and Nadia went to the top of the hill, and there they gazed out over the island, and out to sea, and he stood beside where she stood, and she stood beside where he stood, and the wind tugged and pushed at their hair, and they looked around at each other, but they did not see each other, for she went up before him, and he went up after her, and they were each at the crest of the hill, only briefly, and at different times. As Seth was coming down from the hill, to where Nadia again sat by their tent, a young woman was leaving the contemporary art gallery she worked at in Vienna. Militants from Seth and Nadia's country had crossed over to Vienna the previous week, and the city had witnessed massacres in the streets, the militants shooting unarmed people and then disappearing, an afternoon of carnage unlike anything Vienna had ever seen. Well, unlike anything it had seen since the fighting of the previous century, and of the centuries before that, which were of an entirely different and greater magnitude, Vienna being no stranger in the annals of history to war. And the militants had perhaps hoped to provoke a reaction against migrants from their own part of the world, who had been pouring into Vienna. And if that had been their hope, then they had succeeded, for the young woman had learned of a mob that was intending to attack the migrants gathered near the zoo. Everyone was talking and messaging about it, and she planned to join a human cordon to separate the two sides, or rather, to shield the migrants from the anti-migrants. And she was wearing a peace badge on her overcoat, and a rainbow pride badge, and a migrant compassion badge, the black door within a red heart. And she could see, as she waited to board her train, that the crowd at the station was not the normal crowd. Children and older people seemed absent, and also there were far fewer women than usual, the coming riots being common knowledge, and so it was likely that people were staying away. But it wasn't until she boarded the train and found herself surrounded by men who looked like her brother and her cousins and her father and her uncles, except that they were angry, they were furious, and they were staring at her and at her badges with undisguised hostility and the rancor of perceived betrayal, and they started to shout at her and push her, that she felt fear, a basic animal fear, terror, and thought that anything could happen. And then the next station came, and she shoved through and off the train, and she worried they might seize her and stop her and hurt her. But they didn't, and she made it off, and she stood there after the train had departed, and she was trembling, and she thought for a while. And then she gathered her courage, and she began to walk, and not in the direction of her apartment, her lovely apartment with its view of the river, but in the other direction, the direction of the zoo, where she had been intending to go from the outset, and where she would still go. And all this happened as the sun dipped lower in the sky, as it was doing above Mykonos as well, which, though south and east of Vienna, was after all, in planetary terms, not far away. And there in Mykonos, Said and Nadia were reading about the riot, which was starting in Vienna, and which panicked people, originally from their country, were discussing online how best to endure or flee. By night it was cold, and so Said and Nadia slept fully dressed, not removing their jackets, and huddled together, wrapped inside their blanket, which was above and around and also below them, providing a degree of cushioning against the hard and somewhat uneven ground. Their tent was too small for them to stand, a long but low pentahedron, in shape like the triangular glass prism Said used to have as a child, with which he would refract sunlight into little rainbows. He and Nadia held on to each other at first, cuddling. But cuddling grows uncomfortable after a while, especially in tight quarters. And so eventually, they slept back to front, initially with him pressed against her from behind. And then, at some later point, as the moon passed unseen high overhead, he turned, and she pressed against him. In the morning when he woke, she was watching him, and he stroked her hair, and she touched his bristles above his lip, and below his ear with her finger, and he kissed her, and things felt good between them. They packed up, and Said hefted the large backpack, and Nadia the tent, and they traded one of their smallish backpacks for a yoga mat that they hoped would make sleeping more comfortable. Without warning, people began to rush out of the camp, and Said and Nadia heard a rumor that a new door out had been found, a door to Germany, and so they ran too, in the middle of the crowd initially, but striding swiftly, so they were soon closer to the front. The crowd filled the narrow road and overflowed into the margins and stretched many hundreds of meters at its longest, and Said wondered where they were going. And then up ahead, he saw they were approaching a hotel, a resort of some kind. As they drew nearer, he glimpsed a line of men in uniform blocking their way, and he told Nadia, and they were both frightened and started to slow down and allow people to pass them, because they had seen in their city what happens when bullets are fired into an unarmed mass of people. But in the end, no bullets were fired. The uniformed men simply stopped the crowd and stood their ground, and a few brave or desperate or enterprising souls tried to make it through, running at high speed on either side, where there were gaps. But these few were caught, and after an hour or so, the crowd dispersed, and most people headed back to the camp. Days passed like this, full of waiting and false hopes, days that might have been days of boredom, and were for many. But Nadia had the idea that they should explore the island as if they were tourists. Said laughed and agreed, and this was the first time he had laughed since they arrived, and it warmed her to see it, and so they carried their loads like trekkers in the wilderness and walked along the beaches and up the hills and right to the edges of the cliffs, and they decided that Mykonos was indeed a beautiful place, and they could understand why people might come here. Sometimes they saw rough-looking groups of men, and Said and Nadia were careful to keep their distance, and by evening they were always sure to sleep at the periphery of one of the big migrant camps, of which there were many, and to which anyone might belong, joining or leaving as they saw fit. Once they met an acquaintance of Said's, and this seemed an almost impossible and happy coincidence, like two leaves blown from the same tree by a hurricane, landing on top of each other far away. And it cheered Said greatly. The man said that he was a people smuggler, and had helped people escape their city, and was doing the same thing here, because he knew all the ins and outs. He agreed to help Said and Nadia, and he cut his rate in half for them, and they were grateful, and he took their payment, and said he would have them in Sweden by the following morning. But when they woke, there was no sign of him. He was gone. He had disappeared overnight. Sayd trusted him, and so they stayed where they were for a week, stayed at the same spot in the same camp, but they never saw him again. Nadia knew they had been swindled. Such things were common, and Sayd knew it too, but preferred for a while to try to believe that something had happened to the man that had prevented him from returning. And when he prayed, Sayd prayed not only for the man's return, but also for his safety, until it felt foolish to pray for this man any longer. And after that, Sayd prayed only for Nadia and for his father, especially for his father, who was not with them and should have been. But there was no way back to his father now, because no door in their city went undiscovered by the militants for long, and no one returning through a door who was known to have fled their rule was allowed to live. One morning, Sayd was able to borrow a beard trimmer and trim his beard down to the stubble he had had when Nadia first met him. And that morning, he asked Nadia why she still wore her black robes, since here she did not need to. And she said that she had not needed to wear them even in their own city, when she lived alone, before the militants came, but she chose to, because it sent a signal, and she still wished to send this signal. And he smiled and asked, "A signal even to me?" And she smiled as well and said, "Not to you. You have seen me with nothing." Their funds were growing thinner, more than half the money with which they had left their city now gone. They better understood the desperation they saw in the camps, the fear in people's eyes that they would be trapped here forever, or until hunger forced them back through one of the doors that led to undesirable places, the doors that were left unguarded, what people in the camps referred to as mouse traps, but which, in resignation, some people were nonetheless trying, especially those who had exhausted their resources, venturing through them to the same place from which they had come, or to another unknown place, when they thought anything would be better than where they had been. Sayd and Nadia began to curtail their wanderings to conserve energy, and thus reduce their need for food and drink. Sayd bought a simple fishing rod, available for a less exorbitant price, because its reel was broken, and the line had to be spooled out and pulled back in by hand. He and Nadia journeyed to the sea, and stood on a rock, and put bread on the hook, and tried to fish, alone, two people by themselves, all but surrounded by water the breeze was chopping into opaque hillocks, concealing what lay beneath, and they fished and fished for hours, taking turns, but neither of them knew how to fish, or maybe they were just unlucky, and though they felt nibbles, they caught nothing, and it was as though they were merely feeding their bread to the insatiable brine. Someone had told them the best times to fish were at dawn and dusk, so they stayed out alone longer than they otherwise might have. It was getting dark when they saw four men in the distance, approaching along the beach. Nadia said they should go, and Sayd agreed, and the couple walked away, quickly. But the men seemed to follow, and Sayd and Nadia increased their pace, increased it as much as they could manage, even though Nadia slipped and cut her arm on the rocks. The men were gaining on them, and Sayd and Nadia began to wonder aloud what of their things they could leave behind to lighten the load, or as an offering that might sate their pursuers. Sayd said perhaps the men wanted the rod, and this seemed more reassuring to them than the alternative, which was to consider what else the men might want. So they dropped the rod, but soon after, they rounded a bend and saw a house, and outside the house were uniformed guards, which meant the house contained a door to a desirable place. And Sayd and Nadia had never before been relieved to see guards on the island, but they were now. They came close until the guards shouted at them to stay back, and there Sayd and Nadia stopped, making it clear they would not try to rush the house, sitting down where the guards could see them and where they felt safe. And Sayd considered whether to run back and retrieve the rod, but Nadia said it was too risky. They both regretted dropping it now. They watched for a while, but the four men never appeared, and the two of them set up their tent right there, but were unable to sleep much that night. The days were growing warmer, and spring was stuttering into being in Mykonos, with buds and scattered flowers. In all the weeks they had been there, Sayd and Nadia had never been to the old town, for it was off limits to migrants at night, and they were strongly discouraged from going there even by day, except to the outskirts, where they could trade with residents, which is to say, those who had been on the island longer than a few months. But the gash on Nadia's arm was beginning to fester, and so they had come to the outskirts of the old town to get it tended to at a clinic. A partly shaved-haired local girl, who was not a doctor or a nurse, but just a volunteer, a teenager with a kind disposition, not more than 18 or 19 years of age, cleaned and dressed the wound, gently, holding Nadia's arm as though it was something precious, holding it almost shyly. The two women got to talking, and there was a connection between them, and the girl said she wanted to help Nadia and Said, and asked them what they needed. They said above all, they needed a way off the island, and the girl said she might be able to do something, and they should stay nearby, and she took Nadia's number, and each day Nadia visited the clinic, and she and the girl spoke, and sometimes had a coffee or a joint together, and the girl seemed so happy to see her. The old town was exquisite, white blocks with blue windows scattered along tawny hills, spilling down to the sea, and from the outskirts say that Nadia could spy little windmills and rounded churches and the vibrant green of trees that from a distance looked like potted plants. It was expensive to stay nearby, the camps there often having migrants with more money, and Said was becoming worried. But Nadia's new friend was as good as her word, because very early one morning, she put both Nadia and Said on the back of her scooter and sped them through still quiet streets to a house on a hill with a courtyard. They dashed inside, and there was a door. The girl wished them good luck, and she hugged Nadia tight, and Said was surprised to see what appeared to be tears in the girl's eyes, or if not tears, then at least a misty shine. And Nadia hugged her too, and this hug lasted a long time, and the girl whispered something to her, whispered, and then she and Said turned and stepped through the door and left Mykonos behind. Chapter 7. They emerged in a bedroom with a view of the night sky and furnishings so expensive and well-made that Said and Nadia thought they were in a hotel, of the sort seen in films and thick, glossy magazines, with pale woods and cream rugs and white walls and the gleam of metal here and there, metal as reflective as a mirror, framing the upholstery of a sofa, the switch plate for the lights. They lay still, hoping not to be discovered, but it was quiet. So quiet, they imagined, they must be in the countryside, for they had no experience of acoustically insulating glazing, and everyone in the hotel must be asleep. As they stood, though, they saw from their full height what was below the sky, namely that they were in a city, with a row of white buildings opposite, each perfectly painted and maintained and implausibly like the next, and in front of each of these buildings, rising from rectangular gaps in a pavement that was paved with rectangular flagstones, or concrete laid in the manner of flagstones, were trees, cherry trees, with buds and a few white blossoms, as though it had snowed recently, and the snow had caught in the boughs and leaves all along the street, in tree after tree after tree. And they stood and stared at this, for it seemed almost unreal. They waited for a while, but knew they could not stay in this hotel room forever. So eventually they tried the handle of the door, which was unlocked, and emerged into a hallway, leading to a staircase, one flight down which led them to an even grander staircase, off which were floors with more bedrooms, but also sitting rooms and salons. And only then did they realize that they were in a house of some kind. Surely a palace, with rooms upon rooms and marvels upon marvels and taps that gushed water that was like spring water and was white with bubbles and felt soft, yes, soft, to the touch. Dawn was breaking in the city, and still they had not been discovered, and Said and Nadia sat in the kitchen and pondered what to do. The refrigerator was mostly empty, suggesting no one had eaten from it in some time. And while there were boxes and cans of less perishable food in the cupboards, they did not want to be accused of stealing. So they brought their own food out of their backpack and boiled two potatoes for breakfast. They did, however, take two tea bags from the house and make themselves tea, and each used a spoonful of the house's sugar as well. And if there had been milk in the house, they might have helped themselves to a tiny splash of that too, but there was no milk to be found. They clicked on a television to see if they could discover where they were, and it was soon clear to them that they were in London. And as they watched the television with its intermittently apocalyptic news, they felt oddly normal, for they had not watched a television in months. Then they heard a sound from behind them and saw a man was standing there, staring, and they got to their feet, Sayed hefting their backpack and Nadia their tent. But the man turned wordlessly and headed upstairs. They did not know what to make of this. The man had seemed almost as surprised by his surroundings as they were, and they saw no one else until nightfall. When it was dark, people began to emerge from the upstairs room where Nadia and Sayed had themselves first arrived. A dozen Nigerians, later a few Somalis. After them, a family from the borderlands between Myanmar and Thailand. More and more and more. Some left the house as soon as they could. Others stayed, staking claim to a bedroom or a sitting room as their own. Sayed and Nadia picked a small bedroom in the back, one floor up from the ground, with a balcony from which they could jump to the rear garden, if necessary, and from there, with luck, make an escape. To have a room to themselves, four walls, a window, a door with a lock, seemed incredible good fortune, and Nadia was tempted to unpack, but she knew they needed to be ready to leave at any moment, and so she took out of their backpack only items that were absolutely required. For his part, Sayed removed the photo of his parents that he kept hidden in his clothing and placed it on a bookshelf, where it stood, creased, gazing upon them and transforming this narrow bedroom, at least partially, temporarily, into a home. In the hall nearby was a bathroom, and Nadia wanted to take a shower more than anything, more even than she wanted food. Sayed stood watch outside, while she went in and stripped and observed her own body, leaner than she had ever seen it, and streaked with a grime mostly of her own biological creation, dried sweat and dead skin, and with hair in places from which she had always banished hair, and she thought her body looked like the body of an animal, a savage. The water pressure in the shower was magnificent, striking her flesh with real force and scouring her clean. The heat was superb too, and she turned it up as high as she could stand, the heat going all the way into her bones, chilled from months of outdoor cold, and the bathroom filled up with steam like a forest in the mountains, scented with pine and lavender from the soaps she had found, a kind of heaven, with towels so plush and fine that when she at last emerged, she felt like a princess using them, or at least like the daughter of a dictator who was willing to kill without mercy in order for his children to pamper themselves with cotton such as this, to feel this exquisite sensation on their naked stomachs and thighs, towels that felt as if they had never been used before and might never be used again. Nadia began to put her folded clothes back on, but all of a sudden could not bear to. The stench from them was overpowering, and so she was about to wash them in the tub when she heard a banging on the door and realized she must have locked it. Opening up, she saw a nervous and annoyed and dirty-looking Sayed. He said, "What the hell are you doing?" She smiled and moved to kiss him, and while her lips did touch his did not much respond. "It's been forever," he said. "This isn't our house. I need 5 more minutes. I have to wash my clothes." He stared, but did not disagree. And even if he had disagreed, she felt a steel in herself, which she knew meant she would have washed them anyway. What she was doing, what she had just done, was for her not about frivolity. It was about the essential, about being human, living as a human being, reminding oneself of what one was, and so it mattered, and if necessary, was worth a fight. But the extraordinary satisfactions of the steamy bathroom seemed to have evaporated as she shut the door, and the washing of her clothes, watching the turbid water flow from them down the drain of the bathtub, was disappointingly utilitarian. She tried to recover her former good mood and not be angry with Zaid, who she told herself was not wrong in his own way, just out of rhythm with her in this moment. And when she emerged from the bathroom, wrapped in her towel, her towels, for she had one around her body and another around her hair, and with her dripping but clean clothes in her hands, she was prepared to let the little confrontation between them go. But he said, looking at her, "You can't stand here like that. Don't tell me what I can do." He looked stung by this comment, and also angry, and she was angry as well. And after he had bathed and washed his clothes, which he did perhaps as a conciliatory gesture, or perhaps because once he was cleansed of his own grime, he too realized something of what she had realized. They slept on the slender single bed together without speaking, without touching, or without touching more than the cramped space demanded, for this one night, not unlike a couple that was long and unhappily married, a couple that made out of opportunities for joy, misery. Nadia and Zaid had crossed over on the morning of a Saturday, and by Monday morning, when the housekeeper came to work, the house was already quite full, home perhaps to 50 squatters, from infants to the elderly, hailing from as far west as Guatemala and as far east as Indonesia. The housekeeper screamed as she unlocked the front door, and the police arrived quickly after, two men in old-fashioned black hats, but they only looked in from outside and did not enter. Soon there was a van load more of them, in full riot gear, and then a car with two more, who wore white shirts and black vests and were armed with what appeared to be submachine guns, and on their black vests was the word police in white letters, but these two looked to Zaid and Nadia like soldiers. The residents of the house were terrified. Most had seen firsthand what the police and soldiers could do, and in their terror they spoke more to one another than they otherwise might, strangers speaking to strangers. A sort of camaraderie evolved, as it might not have had they been on the street, in the open, for then they would likely have scattered, and the devil take the hindmost. But here they were penned in together, and being penned in made them into a grouping, a group. When the police called over their bullhorns for everyone to exit the house, most agreed among themselves that they would not do so, and so while a few left, the vast majority stayed, Nadia and Zaid among them. The deadline for their departure grew nearer, then nearer still, and then came and went, and they were still there, and the police had not charged, and they felt they had won some kind of a respite. And then something they could never have expected happened. Other people gathered on the street, other dark and medium and even light-skinned people, bedraggled, like the people of the camps on Mykonos, and these people formed the crowd. They banged cooking pots with spoons and chanted in various languages, and soon the police decided to withdraw. That night, it was calm and quiet in the house, though there were sometimes snatches of beautiful singing that could be heard, in Igbo, until quite late. And Zaid and Nadia lay together and held hands on the soft bed in their little back bedroom, and were comforted by this, as if by a lullaby, comforted even though they kept their bedroom door locked. In the morning, they heard in the distance someone making a call to prayer, at dawn, perhaps over a commandeered karaoke machine. And Nadia was alarmed, waking from a dream and thinking for a second that she was back home in their own city, with the militants, before recalling where she really was. And then she watched, a bit surprised, as Zaid got out of bed and prayed. All over London, houses and parks and disused lots were being peopled in this way. Some said by a million migrants, some said by twice that. It seemed the more empty a space in the city, the more it attracted squatters, with unoccupied mansions in the borough of Kensington and Chelsea particularly hard hit, their absentee owners often discovering the bad news too late to intervene, and similarly the great expanses of Hyde Park and Kensington Gardens, filling up with tents and rough shelters, such that it was now said that between Westminster and Hammersmith, legal residents were in a minority and native-born ones vanishingly few, with local newspapers referring to the area as the worst of the black holes in the fabric of the nation. But even as people poured into London, some were venturing out of it as well. An accountant in Kentish town, who had been on the verge of taking his own life, woke one morning to discover the blackness of a door where the bright entrance to a small but well-lit second bedroom had been. While at first he had armed himself with the hockey stick his daughter had left in his closet, left there along with much else she had abandoned for her gap year, and subsequently he had taken out his phone to call the authorities, he stopped himself to wonder why he was bothering, and proceeded to put away the hockey stick and his phone, and fill his tub as he had planned, and to place the box cutter he had purchased on the little scalloped ledge next to the organic soap his ex-girlfriend would never again use. He reminded himself that he needed to cut lengthwise, if he was serious, up his forearm, and not across it. And though he hated the idea of pain, and also of being found naked, he thought this was the right way to go, well considered and well planned. But the nearby blackness unsettled him and reminded him of something, of a feeling he associated with children's books, with books he had read as a child, or books that had been read to him, rather, by his mother, a woman with a gentle lisp and a gentle embrace, who had not died too young, but who had deteriorated too young, her illness taking with it her speech and her personality, and in the process taking his father too, making him into a distant sort of man. And as the accountant thought this, he thought he might step through the door just once to see what was on the other side, and so he did. Later his daughter and his best friend would receive via their phones a photo of him on a seaside that seemed to have no trees, a desert seaside, or a seaside that was in any case dry, with towering dunes, a seaside in Namibia, and a message that said he would not be returning, but not to worry, he felt something. He felt something for a change, and they might join him. He would be glad if they did, and if they chose to, a door could be found in his flat. With that he was gone, and his London was gone, and how long he remained in Namibia, it was hard for anyone who formerly knew him to say. The residents of the house Sayed and Nadia now occupied wondered if they had won. They savored being indoors, for many had spent many months without a proper roof over their heads. But they knew deep down that a house like this, a palace like this, would not be surrendered so easily, and their relief was therefore fragile. Nadia experienced the environment of the house as a bit like that of a university dormitory at the start of classes, with complete strangers living in close proximity, many of them on their best behavior, trying to add warmth to conversations and strike poses of friendship, hoping these gestures would become more natural over time. Outside the house, much was random and chaotic, but inside, perhaps, a degree of order could be built, maybe even a community. There were rough people in the house, but there were rough people everywhere, and in life roughness had to be managed. Nadia thought it madness to expect anything else. For Said, existence in the house was more jarring. On Mykonos, he had preferred the outskirts of the migrant camps, and he had grown accustomed to a degree of independence from their fellow refugees. He was suspicious, especially of the other men around, of whom there were many, and he found it stressful to be packed in so tightly with people who spoke in tongues he did not understand. Unlike Nadia, he felt in part guilty that they and their fellow residents were occupying a home that was not their own, and guilty also at the visible deterioration brought on by their presence, the presence of over 50 inhabitants in a single dwelling. He was the only one to object when people started to take for themselves items of value in the house, a position that struck Nadia as absurd and physically dangerous for Said besides, and so she had told him not to be an idiot, said it harshly, to protect him rather than to harm him. But he had been shocked by her tone, and while he acquiesced, he wondered at this new way of speaking to one another, this unkindness that was now creeping into their words from time to time, was a sign of where they were headed. Nadia, too, noticed a friction between them. She was uncertain what to do to disarm the cycles of annoyance they seemed to be entering into with one another, since once begun, such cycles are difficult to break, in fact the opposite, as if each makes the threshold for irritation next time a bit lower, as is the case with certain allergies. All the food in the house was very quickly consumed. Some residents had money to buy more, but most had to spend their time foraging, which involved going to the depots and stalls where various groups were giving out rations or serving free soup and bread. The daily supplies at each of these were exhausted within hours, sometimes within minutes, and the only option then was to barter with one's neighbors or kin or acquaintances. And since most people had little to barter with, they usually bartered with the promise of something to eat tomorrow or the next day in exchange for something to eat today. A bartering not so much of different goods exactly, but of time. One day, Seyed and Nadia were returning home with no food, but modestly full bellies, after a reasonably good evening of foraging, and she was experiencing the peculiar sweet aftertaste and acidity of mustard and ketchup. And Seyed was looking at his phone when they heard shouting up ahead and saw people running, and they realized that their street was under attack by a nativist mob, Palace Gardens Terrace being roiled in a way that belied its name. The mob looked to Nadia like a strange and violent tribe, intent on their destruction, some armed with iron bars or knives, and she and Seyed turned and ran, but could not escape. Nadia's eye was bruised and would soon swell shut, and Seyed's lip was split and kept bleeding down his chin and onto his jacket. And in their terror, they each gripped with all their might a hand of the other to avoid being separated. But they were merely knocked down, like many others. And on that evening of riots across their part of London, only 3 lives were lost, not many by the recent standards of where they had come from. In the morning, they felt their bed was too tight for them both, raw as they were from their injuries. And Nadia pushed Seyed away with her hip, trying to make space. And Seyed pushed as well, trying to do the same. And for a second, she was angry. And then they turned face to face, and he touched her swollen shut eye, and she snorted and touched his swollen up lip. And they looked at each other and silently agreed to start their day without growling. After the riots, the talk on the television was of a major operation, one city at a time, starting in London, to reclaim Britain for Britain. And it was reported that the army was being deployed, and the police as well, and those who had once served in the army and the police, and volunteers who had received a week-long course of training. Seyed and Nadia heard it said that nativist extremists were forming their own legions, with a wink and a nod from the authorities. And the social media chatter was of a coming night of shattered glass. But all this would probably take time to organize. And in that time, Seyed and Nadia had to make a decision, whether to stay or to go. In their small bedroom after sunset, they listened to music on Nadia's phone, using the phone's built-in speaker. It would have been a simple matter to stream this music from various websites, but they tried to economize in all things, including the data bundles they had purchased for their phones. And so Nadia downloaded pirated versions whenever she could find them, and they listened to these. She was in any case glad to be rebuilding her music library. From past experience, she did not trust in the continued availability of anything online. One night, she played an album that she knew Seyed liked by a local band popular in their city when they were in their teens, and he was surprised and happy to hear it because he was well aware she was not overly fond of their country's pop music, and so it was clear that she was playing this for him. They sat cross-legged on their narrow bed, their backs propped up by the wall. He extended a hand, palm up on his knee. She took it. "Let's agree to try harder not to speak shittily to each other," she said. He smiled. "Let's promise." "I do." "I do as well." That night, he asked her what the life of her dreams would look like, whether it would be in a metropolis or in the countryside, and she asked him whether he could see them settling in London and not leaving, and they discussed how houses such as the one they were occupying might be divided into proper apartments, and also how they might start over someplace else, elsewhere in the city, or in a city far away. They felt closer on nights when they were making these plans, as though major events distracted them from the more mundane realities of life. And sometimes, as they debated their options in the bedroom, they would stop and look at each other, as if remembering, each of them, who the other was. Returning to where they had been born was unthinkable, and they knew that in other desirable cities, in other desirable countries, similar scenes must be unfolding, scenes of nativist backlash, and so even though they discussed leaving London, they stayed. Rumors began to circulate of a tightening cordon being put in place, a cordon moving through those of London's boroughs with fewer doors, and hence fewer new arrivals, sending those unable to prove their legal residence to great holding camps that had been built in the city's greenbelt, and concentrating those who remained in pockets of shrinking size. Whether or not this was true, there was no denying that an ever more dense zone of migrants was to be found in Kensington and Chelsea and in the adjacent parks, and around this zone were soldiers and armored vehicles, and above it were drones and helicopters, and inside it were Nadia and Said, who had run from war already and did not know where next to run, and so were waiting, waiting, like so many others. And yet, while all this occurred, there were volunteers delivering food and medicine to the area, and aid agencies at work, and the government had not yet banned them from operating, as some of the governments the migrants were fleeing from had. And in this there was hope. Said in particular was touched by a native boy, just out of school, or perhaps in his final year, who came to their house and administered polio drops to the children but also to the adults. And while many were suspicious of vaccinations, and many more, including Said and Nadia, had already been vaccinated, there was such earnestness in the boy, such empathy and good intent, that though some argued, none had the heart to refuse him. Said and Nadia knew what the build-up to conflict felt like, and so the feeling that hung over London in those days was not new to them, and they faced it not with bravery, exactly, and not with panic either, not mostly, but instead with a resignation shot through with moments of tension, with tension ebbing and flowing. And when the tension receded, there was calm, the calm that is called the calm before the storm, but is in reality the foundation of a human life, waiting there for us between the steps of our march to our mortality, when we are compelled to pause and not act, but be. The cherry trees exploded on Palace Gardens Terrace at that time, bursting into white blossoms, the closest thing many of the street's new residents had ever seen to snow, and reminding others of ripe cotton in the fields, waiting to be picked, waiting for labor, for the efforts of dark bodies from the villages. And in these trees, there were now dark bodies too, children who climbed and played among the boughs like little monkeys, not because to be dark is to be monkey-like, though that has been and was being and will long be slurred, but because people are monkeys who have forgotten that they are monkeys, and so have lost respect for what they are born of, for the natural world around them, but not, just then, these children, who were thrilled in nature, playing imaginary games, lost in the clouds of white like balloonists, or pilots, or phoenixes, or dragons, and as bloodshed loomed, they made of these trees that were perhaps not intended to be climbed the stuff of a thousand fantasies. One night, a fox appeared in the garden of the house where Said and Nadia were staying. Said pointed it out to Nadia through the window of their little back bedroom, and they were both amazed to see it and wondered how such a creature could survive in London and where it had come from. When they asked around if anyone else had seen a fox, all said no, and some people told them it might have come through the doors, and others said it might have wandered in from the countryside. And still others claimed foxes were known to live in this part of London. And an old woman told them they had not seen a fox, but rather themselves, their love. They wondered if she meant the fox was a living symbol, or the fox was unreal and just a feeling, and when others looked, they would see no fox at all. Mention of their love had made Said and Nadia a bit uncomfortable, for they had not been very romantic of late, each still perceiving the grating of their presence on the other. And they put this down to being too long in too close proximity, a state of unnatural nearness in which any relationship would suffer. They began to wander separately during the day, and this separation came as a relief to them, though Said worried what would happen if the fighting to clear the area began so suddenly that they would not both be able to return home in time, knowing from experience that a mobile phone could be a fickle connection. Its signal thought in normal circumstances be like the sunlight or the moonlight, but in actuality capable of an instant and endless eclipse. And Nadia worried about the promise she had made Said's father, whom she too had called father, to stay with Said until he was safe. Worried what it would make her to be proven untrue to this promise, and whether that would mean she stood for nothing whatsoever. But liberated from claustrophobic closeness by day, exploring apart, they converged with more warmth at night, even if sometimes this warmth felt like that between relatives rather than between lovers. They began to sit on the balcony outside their bedroom and wait in the dark for the fox to appear below, in the garden. Such a noble animal, noble though it was fond of rummaging in the trash. As they sat, they would on occasion hold hands, and on occasion kiss, and once in a while feel the rekindling of an otherwise diminished fire and go to their bed and torment each other's bodies, never having sex, but never needing to, not anymore, following a different ritual that still resulted in release. Then they would sleep, or if not sleepy, go back onto the balcony and wait for the fox. And the fox was unpredictable. It might come and it might not, but often it did. And when it did, they were relieved, for it meant the fox had not disappeared and had not been killed and had not found another part of town to make home. One night, the fox encountered a soiled diaper, pulled it out of the trash and sniffed at it, as if wondering what it was, and then dragged it around the garden, fouling the grass, changing course again and again, like a pet dog with a toy, or a bear with an unfortunate hunter in its maw. In any case, moving with both design and unpredictable wildness. And when it was done, the diaper lay in shreds. That night, the electricity went out, cut off by the authorities, and Kensington and Chelsea descended into darkness. A sharp fear descended also, and the call to prayer they had often heard in the distance from the park was silenced. They supposed the karaoke player that might have been used for that task was unable to run on batteries. Chapter 8. The complexities of London's electricity network were such that a few motes of nighttime brightness remained in, say, the Nadia's locality, at properties on the edges, near where barricades and checkpoints were manned by armed government forces, and in scattered pockets that were for some reason difficult to disconnect, and in the odd building here and there, where an enterprising migrant had rigged together a connection to a still active high voltage line, risking and in some cases succumbing to electrocution. Overwhelmingly though, around Said and Nadia, it was dark. Mykonos had not been well lit, but electricity had reached everywhere there were wires. In their own fled city, when the electricity had gone, it had gone for all. But in London, there were parts as bright as ever, brighter than any place Said or Nadia had seen before, glowing up into the sky and reflecting down again from the clouds. And in contrast, the city's dark swaths seemed darker, more significant, the way that blackness in the ocean suggests not less light from above, but a sudden drop-off in the depths below. From dark London, Seda Nadia wondered what life must be like in light London, where they imagined people dined in elegant restaurants and rode in shiny black cabs, or at least went to work in offices and shops and were free to journey about as they pleased. In dark London, rubbish accrued, uncollected, and underground stations were sealed. The trains kept running, skipping stops near Said and Nadia, but felt as a rumble beneath their feet and heard at a low, powerful frequency, almost subsonic, like thunder or the detonation of a massive, distant bomb. At night, in the darkness, as drones and helicopters and surveillance balloons prowled intermittently overhead, fights would sometimes break out, and there were murders and rapes and assaults as well. Some in dark London blamed these incidents on nativist provocateurs. others blamed other migrants and began to move, in the manner of cards dealt from a shuffled deck during the course of a game, reassembling themselves in suits and